accession number 9434, reel 9.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 9. What was the next thing that happened while you were at Potige then?
Well, I was naturally glad to be back in one piece from crawling out and finding the front line. But when I got back there, I looked around and I saw there was a body on a, laying on a stretcher, still there. And, of course, first time I'd seen it was before I went up to the line. And that man was Captain Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, Raoul Johnson. He was a French citizen, Paris, from the French. He was a captain in the French army. He was the intelligence officer for the 1st Cavalry Brigade. And he got a bullet right through the brain. And I was most upset, because if ever there was a gentleman of gentlemen, it was Captain Raoul Johnson, you see. I mean, I often had to occasion to go to brigade headquarters, because having no medical officer, I used to have to go up and get the services of Captain Crean for anything special wanted. And I used to see him there, and he was most courteous and delightful man. He had a bullet right through his mouth, right up through the brain. But I was most upset about that.
Now, you during this period, you were dealing with a different sort of wound, perhaps, because this would be high explosive ground level. Did it lead to? Were the wounds different?
Oh yes, very different, very different. My goodness, they were much more severe, much more severe. For instance, one of the worst wounds I had to deal with when we were still at the convent was one day was a private of one of the Yorkshire regiments. Whether it was the West Yorks or the Yorks, I don't remember, but a high explosive shell had dropped right in amongst them and had blown off both his legs, halfway up the thigh, and leaving the femur, that's the thigh bone, exposed in each case leg as if they were two crutches. And this fellow, he got this, to give you an idea of the guts of the British infantryman, all he did was he sat up on the stretcher, looked down at his legs, which had gone, and the bone sticking out. He said, "If only my missus could see me now, give me a cigarette." That was the guts and the courage of those men.
What would you do for someone? What medical treatment could you give him?
What I did was I took him down, get Captain Rogers to look at him. All we could do was to cover the wound up with wounds up with gauze and put him on the first ambulance away, you see. Because you've got to remember that the greatest danger to that man was shock. I mean, the wounds could be dealt with, but the shock to the body and the brain was the greatest danger.
Could we talk about shock a little more?
Yes, shock was a condition which I'm not medically qualified to discuss really, but always I used to hear from the medical officers that I worked with, yes, it doesn't look a very nasty wound, Sergeant, but believe me, the shock, you will feel the shock in about 7 or 8 hours' time. You'll get the reaction, you see, the shock to the frame of the body and the mind. And he said that is the great danger.
So someone like this chap with the legs off, would be, although he was sitting up and smoking cigarettes, could well have the reaction later.
The reaction would be immense.
What would his chances be?
Well, I couldn't tell you. I'm really not qualified sufficiently to give an opinion. But if he were exceptionally strong, he might survive it.
But he'd have to be exceptionally strong.
He'd have to be exceptionally strong to survive that.
The sort of wound that you were getting, so now they involve more mutilation and mangling. Would that be correct?
Yes, much more, because, see, the Germans began to use high explosive instead of shrapnel. The shrapnel wound was it was a nasty wound, but nothing compared to the pieces of metal, jagged pieces of metal that were flying about. They were making nasty wounds. And covering a large area, you see, too. The area of the wound was large.
Well, did you have any special methods that you had to bring into play for wounds covering a large area, or
No, all I could do when I picked them up was to cover the wounds with gauze to keep the dirt and the air etc. away as much as possible, get a bit of wool over the gauze, bandage them, and to keep the air away and keep the dirt and the dust and the atmosphere away, and get them down to the medical officer as quickly as possible. That was my function.
What particular infections were you afraid of in covering the wound in
this way?
Well,
the first one and the most deadly was tetanus. You see, when we went to France, I told you, Captain Lewis told me, he says, the two things here, he says, two troubles, the water's full of typhoid and the ground's full of tetanus. And tetanus, believe me, killed a lot of men in the early stages of the war, which were cured later on because they had the serum for it. They had, I mean, I had three massive injections of tetanus myself.
What? Now, tetanus isn't common now, thanks to these very same or similar injections.
No.
What, did you ever see anyone suffering from tetanus, or would it develop at a later stage?
Oh, it would develop at a later stage. I never saw one.
But you were very aware of the risk.
Aware of the risk, yes. That's why we used to cover those wounds up as quickly as possible, you see.
What other infections might you be afraid of? Or was this
Yes, gangrene, of course. In extremely cold weather in the winter, if there was a large area of wound and the frost got into it, there was an immediate danger of gangrene, that is, poison spreading all over the body quickly, and many a good man died of gangrene with a wound that didn't appear very dangerous.
Was this something also that would develop later rather than the time you had the patients?
Oh, yes, because, I didn't face a very wintry condition until 19, early part of 1917, at the Battle of Arras, which we'll talk about later.
Now, these casualties that were coming in, were they all as fatalistic or as brave as the chap who had his legs off? Or were some people more panicky or nervy about it?
You know, to be absolutely frank, I never saw a panicky soldier, wounded soldier. You see, most of them were probably glad to be out of it. See, out of danger, at least for a time. I never saw a panicky soldier. I saw a soldier whose their nerves had broken and given way. I mean, they were just lying, gibbering idiots. I've seen a soldier laying on a stretcher, gibbering like an idiot, just from the shell shock, being blown unconscious.
Was shell shock? By this time, which is only May 1915, was it an accepted phenomenon as far as you were concerned, or was there still people who thought it was just cowardice?
Well,
what was the situation?
We didn't use the word cowardice. We used to use the word windy. You know, we used the word windy. It was still, so far as my unit was concerned, it was still thought that if a man would complain about being blown up, he was windy. But later on, of course, it became a recognised medical condition, shell shock.
So at this time, would people who were windy, or shell shocked, as it was later called, would they be given, what sort of treatment or sympathy would they be given?
Well, as a rule, they were either charged with malingering or sent down to hospital. And it depended on the officers they were dealing with, but some soldiers, one or two soldiers, would probably try and take advantage of it. But on the whole, it was a genuine condition. And having suffered from it myself, from a bad one, being blown absolutely unconscious for probably a couple of hours, I know what it is, because after I was blown unconscious at Le Hamel in 1918, I couldn't bear to hear a pin drop for the next 3-4 months, and yet I was still in the line for a fortnight after I'd been blown up. But it's a terrible thing because you just can't bear to hear a noise of any sort. And my hair, lost my hair inside 3 months.
We'll come to that later on. Mm. But at this stage, they were mainly considered windy. Now, in deciding, who would decide whether an officer should be done, a soldier should be charged with malingering or should be sent back to hospital? Was that the medical officer who would decide that?
Oh, yes. Every battalion had a medical officer. That would be decided by the doctor.
No, that would be the battalion's doctor, not your doctor.
No, the battalion medical officer would decide that. You see, and it's so dangerous. I will describe to you later on, in 1916, how a man, blown against the side of a trench, was threatened with malingering by an officer when he was almost certainly going to have to fight for his life. I'll just tell you about it later on.
Right. Now, so you were in the White Chateau, and you got back from your mission up to the line. What happened next then?
What happened then was we stayed there for 2 days, and then pulled out of the line, and we stayed there for 2 days, and when we pulled farther back, and I think the brigade stayed there for about another week. We just eased back a little from the chateau down to a road lower down, but I think the brigade stayed in another week, and so did we. I suppose it must have been probably about the 23rd of May by the time that we 4th of May by the time we left the Potage Friesenberg front.
Were you under fire a lot yourself during this time in your dressing station or in the ambulance?
Up in the under the Potage area, yes. At Potage, the bullets came over. They were hitting the trees and the objects around us, going fat all night. You see, stuff coming over. There was something which I didn't tell you there, which is worthy of putting on record. On the night that I crawled up to find that front line, when I got back about 9:30, I was standing at the head of my ambulances, waiting for my officer to turn up. And when up in the tree above the White Chateau was a nightingale singing his heart out. Now, if ever there was a bizarre situation, fancy that one. There's death going on down below on the ground, spare bullets coming over, knocking against the trees all over, and there was this bird up there singing his heart out in the darkness.
The casualties that were suffered by the cavalry brigade while they were on the Friesenberg Bridge, were you always able to cope with the number?
Oh, yes. With what came down, yes. What came down, yes.
So it never got out of hand?
No.
Right. Where did you pull back to when you actually left the whole Potage area?
We pulled back to a hillside just below the town of Cassel in northern France. Cassel. Cassel. We pulled out onto the slopes of the hillside there, and while I was there, a new regiment came out from England, and I recognised some of the men in it, the East Surrey Yeomanry, and they pulled up in a field close to us, and I recognised one or two Croydon chaps, you see, and went over and had a chat with them, and they left their horses there, a proportion of them, and the others went up and went into the line and did infantry duty in the Ypres Salient.
So how long were you at Cassel, and what?
Well, we were there at Cassel, about a fortnight, when suddenly I was given a leave warrant to go to England for 5 days.
Before that, what were you doing while you were at Cassel?
Nothing at all, resting as much as possible.
There was no training? You weren't training? Or
oh, no, no, we were resting. Resting as much as possible. Horses, men, everything, because we'd had a hectic time in the salient, you see.
Did you get any reinforcements?
For the field ambulance?
Or for the actual cavalry squadrons?
For
the cavalry. Did the unit as a whole get any reinforcements?
Not the cavalry field ambulance. We didn't get any reinforcements. But the cavalry regiments would have to get plenty because they had quite severe losses, you see. See, the trouble is when you're under bombardment from high explosive, the proportion of dead is very high. When I'm ground, I'm talking about ground bursts, you see. The proportion of dead is very high.
Right, so you went on leave for 5 days. Yeah. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I just went home and had a good bath and a clean. My mother washed all my gear and I cleaned myself up and went with walks around the countryside outside Croydon, you know, places that I knew, and went and saw people that I knew, let them see that I was still alive.
You'd been quite lucky to get, because this was your second leave.
I was very lucky. I had 3 days, and then I got this 5, you see, this in the same year. But I must tell you that it was a very long time before I got the next one.
Right. So you got back. And where was your unit when you rejoined them?
At Kassel.
They're still there.
Still there, yes. It was still there. This is 1915. Still there, and we went back to even farther, because the fighting died down to trench warfare more or less. From June until September, the fighting died down to trench warfare. But because the preparations were going on all the time for the famous Loos battle, which opened on the 23rd of September, 1915.
Now, how were you involved in those preparations? Was your field ambulance or was the cavalry involved in that at all?
Well, we were keeping training all the time. You know, there were talks to the stretcher bearers, training. You know, keeping them up to scratch with the first aid and all that sort of thing. A route march or two. But not a great deal went on. It was a time of rest, you see.
What were the talks about?
Well, the talks were about all sorts of things. One, I remember one, most interesting one, one of the officers, Captain Hardy, he got a kidney and split it right down the middle in half, laid it on the table, and we all gathered round for a lecture on the kidney and kidney trouble. And all the little veins and courses that run through a kidney, and explaining what it was all about, you see, and how necessary it was to keep the kidneys well flushed. And you know, one of my officers told me, he says when you drink the French beer, he says it's so light and so thin, he says you're really doing your kidneys a favour, because it washes and it scours and cleans them out, you see, it's good for them.
They'd been in France for some time. Would you, as your unit, have any role in preventing or treating venereal diseases of any kind, or was that not?
No. If a man had venereal disease, he was sent down to there was a venereal hospital at the base. There was a special venereal hospital. But I don't remember a case of venereal disease in the field ambulance. I never remember one from all through the war.
What about from the actual cavalry regiments, squadrons?
Well, there may have been, but they would be dealt with by the medical officers of the regiments, you see, so and who would send them straight away down to the venereal hospital at I think it was a place called Etaps.
Now, during this period, it must have become aware that it was going to be an infantry war in the sense that, that cavalry weren't going to play the, yeah. the major role.
Yeah.
Was there any resentment in the cavalry brigade or division about their role, or did they accept that they were just going to be used as infantry and, you know...
No, there was never any resentment. They were always in training as cavalry, but they could, you see, they were so adaptable, these fellows. I always used to marvel at their adaptability. They could go into the trenches and be as good as any infantryman ever born, and yet they had this wonderful ability to ride and fight on horseback. They did quite a lot of trench work that's never been recognised and never heard of. You see, I must tell you, if Sir Douglas Haig ever had a badly threatened point, if a part of the line was badly threatened, the first people he sent for and bunged in there were the cavalry, dismounted.
Now, when they were dismounted, they left their horses somewhere behind the line.
Huh? Well, I see half a squadron would go into the line, and the other half would look after the horses. You see.
Now, the cavalry brigade would form a composite battalion. Is
battalion,
that right?
That's right. They used to make one battalion, equivalent of an infantry battalion, out of the three regiments in the cavalry brigade.
The three squadrons.
Three companies. They used to make a company. You see, a company of about 200 men, and they used to make a couple of hundred men from each cavalry regiment, and the other half, other men in the regiment, would look after the horses and back out of the line. You see.
Right. Now, you were out training and such like. You stayed out until the loose battle, did you?
We stayed out until the loose battle, yes.
You had no periods in the trenches in that time?
No, none in the trenches, no. Not in between.
Now, could you tell me what happened then when the loose offensive opened on the 23rd and 9th? Was your unit and the 1st Cavalry Brigade and Division, were they immediately involved?
Well, no, they were in position, but were not involved because, you see, the battle was a failure, let's face it. The infantry attacks... never reached the objectives. If they reached the objectives, they never held them, you see. The Germans were very strong, counterattacks were very strong, and of course it was in a country which was a very difficult country. They had those, there was one or two of those big slag heaps, the tips, you know, the coal tips, which we call them in England, and to my mind, it wasn't a terribly easy country for the fighting men.
Before the attack failed, had you hoped to be used as cavalry, or not your unit?
Yes, they did. They hoped to be used as cavalry, but there was never a chance of that happening. What we did was, at the instead of being used as cavalry, they waited until the end, till December, and then. The regiments formed the cavalry battalions, formed the troop battalions, and they took over the trenches at the quarries and Hullock. They took over trenches for 3 months, from January to the end of March.
Now, before that then, you weren't involved in any action at all?
No,
or frontline service?
No.
So throughout this period, could you give me an eye, where exactly were you stationed throughout this long period? Because it's
well,
a long period.
We were stationed at a place called Montishaw, which was about 6 or 7 miles in front of general headquarters. You see, when the cavalry were not in the line, they used to be taken well back out of the way. See, and also of course, in the back areas there was plenty of stabling and plenty of room for movement, without interfering with other troops, interfering with supply lines for the infantry. So we were taken back a place close to general headquarters on the channel there. It was a very isolated place. It was just one old chateau, and nowhere to go. We just had some gramophone records, and we had the magazines and one thing and another. Lived a very, except for a bit of training, I told you, the training and lectures we had, it was a quiet life.
Did you get bored and want to get back to action? Or?
No, no. We knew we'd get back quick enough, and we did. We had 3 months of it, you see, from January to the end of March. 3 months in the same place, stuck in the same trenches.
So in January 1916, you went into the Loos sector. Can you tell me exactly where you were sent?
Yes, well, what happened was a field ambulance was formed, just like the cavalry regiments. A few men from number one, new men from number two, and a few men from number nine, cavalry field ambulances. They were a body was got put together with, I think we had four ambulances, under Major R.V. Howie, Royal Army Medical Corps, who, by the way, was H-O-W-E-Y. He was R.V. He was the middleweight and light heavyweight, later light heavyweight officer's champion of the British Army. So he was, he's not a man to be, to be trifled with. But I found him first class, and I never had the slightest trouble. I was the sergeant in charge. I was the senior NCO in charge of this detachment. There was I used to get other sergeants used to visit me while I was during the 3 months, but they were only temporary. They would come up for a week.
What was the name of your combined ambulance unit?
There was no special name given to it. It was just a combined cavalry field ambulance. No special name.
Could you describe in a bit more detail the organisation of it?
Yes, well, we had Major Howie, and we had three medical officers, myself, the stretcher bearers, and the REMC and the IOC driver, that's all. You see, we were going up to trenches. We weren't going up to where places where we had to cover over, go over over country, open country. We went up to places where you stepped into the communication trench, and that was that.
So you were changing your role in the thing. You were now becoming the equivalent of battalion. You were actually being line troops.
Yes, yes.
So could you tell me exactly, you went into the Loos sector.
Yes.
Could you tell me about where exactly in the Loos sector you were?
Yes, we formed the ambulance at a place called Samer in France, S-A-M-E-R. Samer was the organisational point, and we went up to a place called Noeulimines, N-O-E-U-X-L-E-S-M-I-N-E-S, Noeulimines, that's on the Loos front. And Noeulimines, and we went into the line at a place called Vermelles. No vehicles. The vehicles were left behind at Noeulimines, but I took about 12 stretcher bearers, and myself. We went up to Vermelles, where we had a cellar under the ruins of the brewery. The brewery was flattened to the boards. And there was a hole in the ground, and down it, we went down some steps, and there was a big, largest space where we could, we got a crate. There was a crate there, and we arranged this crate so that we could put a stretcher on it for the medical officer to examine a patient. We had some carbide lamps, carbide lamps for lighting down there. I had a variety of medical officers there. There was Captain T.O. Graham, who was an ear, nose and throat specialist, and afterwards became president of the Royal the Irish Medical Association. He was a Dublin man. I had Captain Ambrose Heath, who was the leading dietitian with his famous laboratory in London. And there was Captain Blood, who was a tropical diseases specialist. I tell you, we had some very, very celebrated men in that in that little combined field ambulance. I suppose one could say, square pegs in round holes, because they were really, instead of walking about the muddy trenches, they